This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. Inside our virtual space, you and I get briefed together on the big questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. If it works for you, if it doesn't, or you know how it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And my thanks to LaserASDF, #AlonaXmas and 09AMS97, who've all reviewed us recently. This week, we're talking about US politics. The midterm elections are coming up at the beginning of November, the first opportunity since 2016 for the country to pass judgment on the Trump administration. There have been further extraordinary revelations from inside the White House this week. So just how important are these midterm elections? That's the question in this week's episode of The Briefing Room. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. There are plenty for you to listen to in our archive, and you might, for example, be interested in the piece we made about the Mueller investigation earlier this year.
Your vote in 2018 is every bit as important as your vote in 2016. Although I'm not sure I really believe that, but, you know. But it's still important, remember. That's why we will be campaigning for every last vote in every part of our great country.
You know who. And when President Trump was elected, his stars were in alignment. His Republican Party held and holds a majority in both houses of Congress. But on November the 6th, US voters go to the polls for congressmen and women, senators and state governors in what are called the midterm elections. And that ascendancy might change. Is it likely to? And whether it does or not, what are the implications for America? Step inside the briefing room to find out. But first, to illustrate how midterm elections can make a difference, we invited Ken Goldstein, Professor of Politics at the University of San Francisco, to survey their recent history.
So, Bill Clinton, elected president in 1992, takes office in January of 1993 and has an ambitious legislative agenda. He gets the economic legislation through, he gets the crime bill through, health care does not pass, and partly because of the failure of health care, the Democrats have a massive loss in 1994.
There is a lot of evidence, you know, that the American people believe, a majority of them, and have believed for decades now, that divided government may work better than united government. As you know, I disagree with that.
It was Newt Gingrich versus Bill Clinton after the 1994 election. And in Gingrich versus Clinton, there were government shutdowns in 1995 and 1996, but they came together sort of that summer to pass welfare reform. Now, the reason why I say sorta, which just speaks to the vastly different world we're in, there were more moderate or even liberal members of the Republican Party in Congress who pressured Newt Gingrich, who were willing to make a deal with Bill Clinton to get that welfare reform bill passed in the summer of 1996. So as bad and as toxic as that seemed after the 1994 election, people were still reaching across the aisle, and a signature legislative achievement of Bill Clinton's was bipartisan in nature. In 2006, George W. Bush is president, and we're heading into the midterms. Democrats took back control of the House of Representatives. Most Americans believed that the decision to go to war in Iraq was a mistake, and they held George W. Bush's party, the Republican Party, accountable for that.
This is a close election. If you look at race by race, it was close. The cumulative effect, however, was not too close. It was a thumping.
Basically, after that 2006 election, although there were a few things that George W. Bush could do unilaterally, his ability to get any legislation whatsoever through Congress was done. In 2010, Barack Obama is in the second year of his presidency. He has gotten a major stimulus package passed. He has gotten legislation to reform the financial markets passed. And he has also gotten healthcare reform passed. Then Election Day 2010, Republicans gain a historic victory.
Now, I'm not recommending for every future president that they take a shellacking like I did last night. I'm sure there are easier ways to learn these lessons. But I do think that this is a growth process.
From that point on, Barack Obama certainly was able to do things, but Barack Obama basically was not able to do anything legislatively after the 2010 election. So he could do things that presidents can do on their own, executive orders. Although the ability to issue executive orders is a very powerful power for the president of the United States. As we have seen, they are temporary by definition. The next president can also issue an executive order or do things that rescind those. So President Donald Trump was able to basically rescind the Iranian agreement. He was able to rescind some executive orders that Barack Obama did on the environment, and he was able to rescind DACA, which was the immigration policy aimed at younger people. The 2010 election created complete stasis in this country, complete gridlock in this country. And so the combination of a big victory by the Republicans in 2010 and the toxic partisan environment we are in now really froze our legislative politics.
Ken Goldstein with How It's Been. Now for How It Is. Who gets to vote? Where and for what? Let's get the facts from Elena Schneider, campaign reporter for the website Politico. First, Elena Schneider, what is the current makeup of the House and the Senate, and what changes would it take to lead to a change of control in either one?
So right now, Republicans control both the House and the Senate. Republicans have a 23-seat majority or edge in the House, and in the Senate, they have a two-state edge. So for Democrats to flip, to retake those two chambers, they'll have to win 23 House seats and flip two Senate seats.
Now, how many of the seats are up for grabs? Is it all the House seats and all the Senate seats, or just some of them?
All 435 House seats are up for grabs, and about a third of the Senate is up because senators only run every 6 years. So it's not the entire Senate map, but certainly one that looks really good for Republicans at this moment.
So are more Republican seats up this year or more Democrat?
More Democrats are on defense this year. These were all senators who were elected in 2012. Remembering back, this was a presidential year, a year Obama won his second term. And we've got a whole slate of candidates who are running in states that Trump won, in some cases by double digits, if not by 20 points or more. And that's why Republicans feel much better about holding on to the Senate right now, because they're really on offense. They've really got a lot of opportunity to grow, whereas Democrats are very much on their heels trying to keep these Democratic senators in place in states that are really tough for them, that are going to be very difficult to hold on to in November.
So it's going to be much easier for the Democrats to win the House than it is to win the Senate, from what you're saying. Now, if you were a Democrat or Republican and somebody offered you the choice, you can either have the House or you can have the Senate, which one would you go for? Which is the most important?
I think at this point there is a certain amount of awareness that, and the Senate obviously is the chamber that has a lot more control. They make judicial appointments. We're seeing right now Judge Kavanaugh, who's being considered as a Supreme Court justice. Those are all decisions that are made by the Senate. But the House certainly has a lot of control, and what they can really do in the House is chunk up President Trump's agenda, so stop him from moving forward any more legislatively. Another key element for the House is that they can also bring impeachment proceedings, and that's something where Democrats, at least some Democrats, would really love to be in a position to take. So at this point, I think at this, they'd be happy to take either, but they are much more likely to take the House.
Now, which states are people really looking at and saying these are the key ones?
The perennial battleground states are going to continue to be really fascinating this year for a number of different reasons. So take Arizona, for example. This is a state that is diversifying. It's becoming younger. And a lot more people of color are voting in that state. And it's been in Republican hands for quite some time. But Democrats feel like Arizona is a place where they can really see some movement. And there's a really interesting Senate race out there. It's an open Senate seat, so no incumbent is currently holding it. So Kristen Sinema is the Democrat who's running. She's sort of a classic moderate Democrat, what we call a blue dog Democrat. And she's running against another Congresswoman, Martha McSally, who's represented a battleground House seat, but has hugged onto President Trump's agenda pretty closely to get through her primary. But look, the key in this Senate race is everyone's going to be looking at performance and what it might mean for 2020.
And are there particular demographic profiles which are in play this time?
There are certainly voters who Democrats feel like they have a real opportunity to make headway with. They tend to be suburban, well-educated, often affluent people who are living right outside of major cities. So right outside of Houston, Chicago, Philadelphia. Those are the kinds of voters that Democrats feel they can make real headway with and make this check and balance argument about the president and say, look, we know that you don't really like this president. And we think that not only do you need to voice your concern with him in 2020, you also need to put a check on his power by electing a Democrat in Congress. Now, a lot of these districts are not traditionally Democratic. These are sort of your classic, you know, low tax, no government sort of voters. But I think that there's been a real shift ever since Trump took over the Republican Party, them being uncomfortable with his rhetoric and his approach, especially sort of his more nationalist focused rhetoric, that they're uncomfortable with it. And so that's why Democrats really feel they can make inroads there. And also, those are the kinds of voters who are most excited that we're seeing in polling about voting in November. And that's really what's key. Those are the people who Democrats really need to convince are the people who are actually going to show up and vote.
Elena Schneider. So it looks at this stage, and I suppose a lot can happen between now and November the 6th, that the Democrats have a shot at winning the House of Representatives, but are less likely to win the Senate. In a referendum on the Trump presidency, this seems more like a draw than a win or a loss. But what are the potential consequences of a result like this? Joining me in the briefing room are two scholars from the United States whose business it is to study this kind of thing. From Boston, Elaine Kmark of the Brookings Institution, and from Atlanta, Jeff Lazarus of Georgia State University. Jeff Lazarus, we tend to say every set of elections is really important. No set of political analysts ever say an election's not important. What do you make of these ones?
Yeah, it's kind of a cliche to say that whatever election is coming up is the most important election in history or the most important election of our lifetime. But in this case, it might actually be true, maybe not literally true, but the upcoming elections are definitely a very important referendum on Donald Trump himself, Donald Trump's handling of the American government, and as well, whether or not the Republican Party is going to be able to continue on in the same manner as it has for the past 18 months.
Elaine, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think the reason these elections are so important is because of the potential impact they have on the Trump presidency itself, and even potentially ending the Trump presidency before 2020.
Well, we'll come to how that might happen in a moment. Now, we've already heard on this program that it's going to be very hard for the Democrats to take the Senate, even if they do manage to take the House. So let's look at first, what would be the consequences of the Democrats taking the House, but they don't get the Senate?
Well, the most important consequence would definitely be the Democrats would take over the ability to launch investigations into the activities of Donald Trump and other White House officials, which is something that you basically can't do in the minority. So once the Democrats gain this power, if indeed they do, they would be able to publicly use their forum to expose any malfeasance that they find. And that could, in an indirect and long-term way, open the door toward impeachment.
How would that be any more than is already going on in the Robert Mueller investigation? Elaine?
Well, I guess I would agree with Jeff in that if the Democrats take over, they can launch investigations. The issue, though, is we've already had a massive investigation going on for more than a year now. And I think that the Democrats may not need to start any new investigations. They may simply take the Mueller report and go directly to articles of impeachment.
Jeff Lazarus, if they've won the House but they haven't won the Senate, in which they, if you wanted an impeachment, you'd have to get a two-thirds majority, what would be the point in impeaching the president in the House of Representatives?
I actually think that without majority in the Senate, as of right now, there wouldn't really be much of a point to doing that right away. So I would actually disagree. I am of the opinion that the Democrats would probably not launch impeachment proceedings immediately, because ultimately impeachment is much more a political act than it is a legal act. So if you're in the House of Representatives and you want to launch impeachment, you have to have some reasonable amount of confidence that the Senate's going to go along. And a Republican Senate's not going to go along as long as there's a Republican president whose popularity is even remotely in normal levels. You'd have to see the president's popularity take a pretty steep nosedive before a Republican Senate is going to go along with impeachment. So that's why I'm of the opinion that if the Democrats win the House, they're probably going to use that position to spend some time trying to drive down President Trump's popularity, which would then open the door to impeachment.
If the Democrats win the House, does it effectively mean that Trump can't get any legislation through? They just won't let him?
To be blunt, yes. It's already hard enough to get legislation passed, even when one party controls both chambers of Congress. With the high levels of political polarization between the two parties, and on top of that, the added level of animosity created by how divisive Donald Trump is, and on top of that, the unusual nature of many of the policy priorities coming out of the White House, I think that a Democratic House of Representatives would almost certainly effectively veto virtually anything coming out of the White House, or virtually anything that I could see this White House reasonably suggesting.
So, Elaine Kaymark, in that case, what can Trump get done and how can he do it?
He can try to issue executive orders, although executive orders are really overrated. You cannot use an executive order to do something that Congress has already said you can't do. You can't undo law or statute with an executive order. So executive orders kind of move into the regulatory space, and they are much more limited in their impact than people believe they are. So really, there's not much that Trump can get done other than In the area of foreign policy, where presidents have a great deal more latitude than they do in domestic policy, this is where people have always been worried about Donald Trump and about the erratic nature of his leadership. And people continue to worry about Trump in the area of foreign policy because he does not seem to behave or think like any prior American president, Democrat or Republican.
Jeff Lazarus, let's take the contrary case for a moment. Let's suppose for a moment that actually the Democrats don't win the House or don't do very well. What would be the implications of that for American politics for the next few years?
I think you would see the Republican Party continue to put up with the unusual actions and words of Donald Trump and continue to be relatively silent about it while they continue to go along and reap the policy benefits of having a Republican president, including nominating judges and repealing left-leaning regulations.
And what would be the impact of such a defeat on the Democrats themselves?
I think that if the Democrats lost, it would be morally devastating. I think that even though the economy is good by most standard measures, in America, election results tend to come down to presidential popularity and how well the economy is doing. So even though the economy is doing relatively well, President Trump is historically unpopular. And if the Democratic Party cannot win at least a House majority under those circumstances, you're going to see a tremendous number of people in the party start going after the leadership.
But we also hear quite a lot about how the people who support him really love him as much as they ever did, and no matter what's thrown at him, they get to like him more. Doesn't that play in a big way for him, Elaine K. Mark?
The people who really support him do support him, love him, and will continue. However, they are not a majority. I've written about this several times, and I call it the shrinking Republican Party, and others have observed the same thing.
Yes, I agree 100%. And I would even add that we tend to focus on the percentage of people who approve of Donald Trump in these ever-present approval tracking polls. But one of the things that we don't focus as much on is the percentage of people who disapprove of the president. And right now, Donald Trump is well above 50% disapproval, which is enormously high for presidents at this point in their administration. And moreover, of the people who say that they disapprove, 90% or more of them say that they strongly disapprove. So the level of animosity toward Donald Trump among American voters is very, very high.
Now, let's talk a bit about going back to the scenario whereby the Democrats do pretty well in the House. Do the kind of Democrats who get elected, will that have an impact going forward to the presidential elections and the Democratic platform?
Yes, but remember, we are not a parliamentary system. So the ties between the legislature and the executive are not very close. There's a lot more independence than there is in a parliamentary system.
Now, it sounds very weird to our listeners to be thinking about a presidential election already, but you're going to start on this process again pretty soon, aren't you?
Yeah, the process in some ways has already started. The presidential election is preceded by a series of primary elections, which themselves are preceded by a process which some people call the invisible primary, which involves prospective presidential candidates visiting party leaders and big donors and seeking out their support and visiting early primary states like New Hampshire and Iowa to try to lay the groundwork for a campaign. And what you're seeing already this year is many Democrats are spending a lot of time in Iowa and New Hampshire and other similar states. And that's not a coincidence. You know, with Trump being so unpopular, what you're going to see is every Democrat who thinks that they've ever wanted to be president is going to think this is their year to do it. And you're going to see a very crowded primary field on the Democratic side. And the infighting is going to start sooner than anybody probably thinks.
Jeff Lazarus there and Elaine K. Mark. Of course, no week in America these days goes by without a White House revelation. But this week, and so close to the midterms, they've been even more astonishing than usual. But will the new ones have any effect? And what do they tell us about the state of American politics? Larry Sabato is a political analyst at the University of Virginia, and this is not his first visit to the briefing room. Larry writes a blog called Sabato's Crystal Ball, and I've asked him in for a gaze. Larry, I mean, there's been a lot of noise over here in the last few days. There's this new book from Bob Woodward, one of the journalists who uncovered Watergate, of course, and an extraordinary article in the New York Times. Now, for our audience, could you just briefly explain what all this is about?
What it is all about is Donald Trump. And even though he's very unhappy about what's being said, he enjoys being the center of attention. It's not as though anything revealed in Bob Woodward's book or this new New York Times op-ed by a member of the Trump administration, apparently very senior, claiming that Trump is often very off his rocker and simply cannot be relied upon to make good decisions. It's not as though we don't know any of this. We have had revelations all the way along in this very unusual administration. It's the combination of the two that has made such an impact. Bob Woodward is the best known reporter in the United States. Of course, he goes back to Watergate. So there is no one who does not answer a call from Bob Woodward. Even the president said, if Bob had reached him, he would have talked to him. I don't believe that, but that's what the president said. Then, following Woodward's revelations, which pretty much track with the op-ed in the New York Times, the presentation of that op-ed has really shaken the Trump administration itself. Trump is said to be on a rampage in the White House, and some of his aides are just wondering what's going to happen next. So this is something that we haven't faced really ever. I don't think you can compare Trump to Nixon. Nixon was much more rational.
Now, of course, what happens next will partially depend on quite how that rampage, if it happens, goes. Let's suppose for the moment that he doesn't develop it much from here. What impact does something like this actually have on real voters at a point when they come to cast votes?
You asked the right question, when they come to cast votes, because there are really two impacts, or rather one non-impact and one real impact. The non-impact is on switching votes, because no one is ever going to get out of their foxhole. I'm absolutely convinced of it. If you are for Trump, you love Trump, and you don't care what the news media are saying. And if you're against Trump, you've hated him from the beginning. And if he brought heaven down to earth, you still wouldn't support him. That's where we are in the United States. We're as deeply divided as we've been in our history, except for the Civil War. But there's another effect that matters, and that is energizing some voters and depressing others, depressing their turnout. We have a midterm election in almost exactly 2 months for the entire U.S. House, a third of the U.S. Senate, and for 36 of the 50 governorships. What this is doing is depressing the Republican turnout, and it's energizing the Democratic turnout because they are determined to send a message to Donald Trump, and they want to build in a check and balance into the government, which currently is entirely Republican, and soon even the Supreme Court will be controlled by conservative Republicans.
So I suppose what you're saying, Larry, is that those Republicans who are more worried about it, they're not going to switch and vote Democrat. They just might kind of quietly not vote.
That's it, exactly. Or they won't make those extra phone calls to get their aunts and uncles and cousins to the polls. They won't stay in the headquarters and make telephone calls, persuasive calls to undecided voters, because they're simply not that excited about voting. And some of them even recognize that a check on Trump would be a good thing. That doesn't mean they'll vote Democratic. But as you say, it may mean they don't vote or they don't have the same energy that they normally do in getting out the Republican vote.
Now, OK, your website is called Sabato's Crystal Ball. So let's look into it, Larry. What's your guess as to what the results will be in the midterms?
Well, we follow the campaigns for every single seat. And right now we have Democrats slightly over the total they need to get a majority in the House. They need to gain 23 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, and we have them at about 25 seats. So they're a little bit over what they actually need. I should tell you that some of the academic models that project based on current conditions have Democrats picking up over 40 seats. We're more cautious than that. We're conservative in these kinds of analyses because we recognize that Trump voters sometimes surprise us, as they did in 2016. But right now, it looks reasonably good for the Democrats to take over the House. In the Senate, because of the seats that are up, it's actually more likely that Republicans will gain seats than that Democrats will gain the two seats they need to take control of the Senate. But I should tell you, and you've seen this in British politics and other democracies around the world, occasionally you have what's called a wave, and it can build and build and be hidden for a while. But in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, it starts to emerge from the sea. And very occasionally, it turns into a tsunami that can sweep away virtually anyone and anything.
Larry Sabato, and my thanks to him, to Ken Goldstein, Elena Schneider, Elaine Kmark, and Jeff Lazarus. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Siobhan O'Connell, and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We read them, you know.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.